Earth Sky.
Welcome to Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. This is Earth Sky 22, 22 minutes of great science and great music. I'm your host, Jorge Salazar. We have stories about a historic spaceflight, whales, and the evolution of their diet, and life deep inside the Earth. Here's the scientist's soundbite.
No one had ever gotten into this deep layer of the Earth's crust before and looked at what was there.
You're listening to Stephen Giovannani, professor of microbiology at Oregon State University. He led a science team that found life in rocks collected over a kilometer below the seafloor in the North Atlantic. What Giovannani found were bacteria in the deepest layer of Earth's crust. Dr. Giovannani is here to explain more.
Thanks, Jorge.
So tell us, what are the main findings of your investigation of life at the deepest layers of Earth's crust?
Well, this expedition investigated microbial life in gabbros, which are rocks in the deep part of the ocean crust, and discovered bacteria there. We weren't that surprised to find organisms there because the temperatures were about right and we knew there was water there. The big surprise was the type of bacteria we found. They weren't the same ones that are found in the basalts above. They were an entirely different group of microorganisms. The interesting thing about this discovery was that the organisms we found down there were normally associated with degrading hydrocarbons. And the bacteria in the rocks above are quite different, not associated with that kind of activity. So that raised the question, where are those hydrocarbons coming from?
Yeah, tell us more. Like, where are these hydrocarbons, these bacteria that you found in this unlikely place way down deep in the earth? They're eating hydrocarbons, oil, methane, I think. Yeah, tell us more.
So the bacteria that we found down there were closely related to organisms that are normally found in oil reservoirs or methane deposits. That was a surprise, but it turns out that there's an explanation for this, that other scientists associated with this expedition and also working at a nearby and very exciting area called the Lost City Hydrothermal Vent have reported that hydrocarbons are in this area, in this region, are being formed abiotically. That means that essentially carbon and hydrogen molecules are being made from carbon dioxide and hydrogen in interactions between water and rock and producing organic matter. That has a lot of implications. First of all, it says that this community of microorganisms far below the seafloor may be subsisting on materials that are not derived from photosynthesis at the surface. So they may be truly independent of the surface biosphere. Secondly, it has implications for understanding what life might be like on other planets. And the planet that everybody is most interested in, of course, is Mars, because it's known that there's water on Mars, and it's known that Mars is producing methane. And it's a bit of a mystery where that methane comes from. So one possibility is that it's being produced by abiotic processes like this. And there's always the possibility that there might be life on Mars. There's no direct proof of that at this time. Enough is known about Mars to postulate that if there is life there, it's probably some sort of subterranean life occurring in rocks very much like the rocks that we were investigating at the Atlantic Massif.
That was microbiologist Stephen Giovannani. We're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science, heard on 1,500 stations around the world. We're taking your questions on Facebook. To find us on Facebook, search for Earth Sky. Next up, the global night sky with Skywatcher Deborah Bird. Deborah, what's up?
Hey, Jorge. I want you and everyone listening to mark your calendar. There's a lunar eclipse coming up on December 20th or 21st. Same event for all of us, but the date you see it will depend on your time zone.
Cool. So what is a lunar eclipse?
A lunar eclipse always happens at full moon when the Earth, Sun, and Moon line up so exactly that Earth's shadow falls on the Moon. During a lunar eclipse, you can watch the dark shadow of the Earth creeping across the Moon's face. And then at mid-eclipse, when the Moon is completely submerged in Earth's shadow, there's the possibility that the Moon will turn blood red.
And why blood red?
Well, it's because Earth has an atmosphere, and some sunlight filters through our atmosphere into the shadow on the Moon, turning it red in color. It's very beautiful.
Cool. So this is December 20th or 21st for a lunar eclipse, a solstice eclipse.
That's right, Jorge. This eclipse is happening almost simultaneously with the December solstice, which in 2010 occurs on December 21st, when the sun will be southernmost for this year. A full moon is always opposite the sun, so this December full moon is very far to the north on the sky's dome. That means the eclipsed moon will ride very high in the sky, as seen from the northern hemisphere. And from the southern hemisphere, the same is true, a very northerly lunar eclipse. There won't be a lunar eclipse this far north on the sky's dome again until December 21st of the year 2485.
I probably won't make that one.
Nah, me neither, Jorge, but what the heck.
Thanks, Deborah.
Thank you, Jorge. And remember, no special equipment needed to see a lunar eclipse, although binoculars will enhance the view. We have lots more info at the Tonight area of EarthSky.org.
EarthSky's Deborah Bird. And we're EarthSky, a clear voice for science. Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. Emily Howard is here to report a possible breakthrough on Parkinson's disease. Emily, what's happening?
Well, Clemens Scherzer is a neurologist at Harvard Medical School, and in late 2010, he published a study on Parkinson's disease. That's an illness that slowly destroys the brain and disrupts motor movement. Scherzer's team has made what they call a breakthrough in understanding Parkinson's, one that could help with treatment.
We found that the genes that the mitochondria need to function are working sluggishly.
Mitochondria are in every human cell, and they're like tiny power plants. They convert sugar into a substance that our cells can use as fuel. Scherzer discovered that in patients with Parkinson's, the genes that control these mini power plants are working too slowly. And he added that there's a way to speed up these sluggish genes.
Our study identifies this power switch, PGC1-alpha, as a new pathway for treatment of Parkinson's disease, in particular the early stages. And that's really the most exciting result, is to have this new therapeutic target, PGC1-alpha.
He said PGC1-alpha, that is a master gene that controls the activity of the genes in charge of mitochondria, those power plants inside of the cells. Scherzer said that a medication that targets PGC1-alpha and revs up mitochondria could potentially slow down Parkinson's disease. And Scherzer suggested that such a medication could be available in as little as 5 to 10 years.
It's actually an excellent target for new medicines because drug companies have been working on this target for many years for other diseases, particularly for diabetes. And so they're already many compounds or chemicals out there, and also already medications out there that work on this energy pathway.
Hope for treating Parkinson's disease. Thanks, Emily.
Thank you, Jorge.
Earth Sky is Emily Howard, and we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. This is EarthSky, a clear voice for science. Ryan Britton is here with a story of weird science about bacteria used to repair buildings. Ryan, what's up?
Well, I'm here to talk today about a new Bacillophila bacteria, which was engineered by researchers at the University of Newcastle in England to fill in and repair concrete right down to those microscopic cracks that you can't see with the naked eye. So imagine spraying a solution, a liquid filled with bacteria, and these little bacteria guys are programmed to swim down into the concrete as far as they can go. And they know they've hit a dead end when they start piling up on each other. And so when this happens, they start to repair concrete. Some produce calcium carbonate crystals. This is a building material. Others produce long fibrous cells that act as reinforcement. And still others produce a glue that bonds, you know, everything together. And what you end up with is a filler for concrete that is as strong as the concrete itself.
Ryan, I got two questions. One, is this as gross as it sounds? And the other one is, how useful is this?
It could be as gross as it sounds, but it also could be very useful. You know, right now, the Newcastle team points out that about 5% of all carbon dioxide emissions are generated through the production of concrete. So this filler could prolong the life of existing structures, and so it could have a positive environmental effect.
We're talking about genetically engineered bacteria, and I'm sure people are wondering about the risks. Ryan, tell us about that.
Right. And this is where it could get gross. I mean, first of all, I should say that the Newcastle researchers have already engineered a kill switch. So if the bacterium gets too far away from the presence of existing concrete, then they're supposed to stop production. But also, Annalee Newitz, who blogs for io9.com, had thought of an idea that maybe some workers, you know, those that spray this bacteria onto cracked concrete, might accidentally inhale some of this Bacillophila, and you end up with a bunch of workers with mouths full of concrete.
Ooh, that's kind of gross.
Right. And so the project is at the beginning stages. So, you know, we don't know if it's going to make it to market yet.
So where, Ryan, can inquiring minds find out more?
Well, you can find more about this story on popsci.com. I also mentioned io9.com. And you can also find it on MSNBC, among others.
Thanks, Ryan.
You're welcome.
Earth Sky's Ryan Britton. Find us as Earth Sky on Facebook, Earth Sky Science on Twitter, and at earthsky.org. This is Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. Emily Howard is back with the latest science on whales and the evolution of what they eat. Emily, what's happening?
Well, recently I spoke with Samantha Price of the University of California, Davis, and she researches evolution in whales and fish. Now, according to Dr. Price, the old saying, you are what you eat, is truer than you may expect. Dr. Price says that diet is linked to where an organism lives, how it interacts with its environment, and also its size. For example, blue whales, these are the largest animals known to have ever existed in the world. Their diet of these microscopic little sea creatures known as krill enables them to grow into these giants of the sea.
So this seems very strange that you have a very large size and so you're eating something so small. But these organisms that are small, they're highly nutritious, and they're also exceedingly abundant. So if you specialize to capture vast quantities of these highly abundant and nutritious prey, it provides you the energy that you need to grow so big.
Another interesting example of diet being linked to large size in whales is the case of whales that eat squid, such as the sperm whale, which can grow to 20 meters or 67 feet long.
Squid are generally very deep water living. And so whales that eat them need to dive deeply and spend more time underwater. And large size actually confers energetic advantages when diving, certain physiological things. They can hold more oxygen, things like that.
Aside from giant whales, according to Price, the whale family covers a diverse catalog of body sizes, from blue whales to smaller porpoises and dolphins. And she said that whales that eat fish evolved smaller bodies over time because that makes it easier for them to maneuver when catching their dinner. Another really fascinating thing I found out from Dr. Price is that the ocean allowed whales to grow very large.
So it's the buoyancy of water actually reduces gravitational constraints on size. And so you will never see a land mammal getting as large as whales because they have so many other constraints on them from gravity.
So when you get down to it, whales have done an incredible job of adapting to their environments and doing so very quickly. In fact, Dr. Price says that 50 million years ago, whales actually were land animals roughly the size of dogs. 10 to 15 million years ago, they became fully aquatic and have just taken off evolutionarily. So to you and me, Jorge, 10 to 15 million years, that's a really long time. But in terms of evolution, that's but the blink of an eye.
Very cool. Thanks, Emily, for the insight.
Thank you, Jorge.
Earth Sky's Emily Howard. You'll find us as Earth Sky on Facebook, Earth Sky Science on Twitter, and at earthsky.org. We're taking your questions on Facebook. To find us on Facebook, search for Earth Sky. The space transport company SpaceX made headlines in late 2010 when they launched into orbit and recovered the Dragon spacecraft carried by the Falcon 9 rocket. This was the first time a privately owned company had ever done this. Here on the line to explain more is astronomer Phil Plate, who writes the Bad Astronomy blog for Discover magazine. Dr. Plate, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Now, the space transport company SpaceX today successfully launched and recovered a spacecraft from orbit. Explain to us what happened here.
Well, SpaceX is a private company that is run out of Texas, and they have a couple of rockets, the Falcon 1 and the Falcon 9. And the Falcon 1 was a test vehicle that successfully has launched into space a few times over the past couple of years. But the Falcon 9 is much larger, and it can lift a lot more into space. And this was the second flight. This one was even more important because on top of the rocket was a space capsule called Dragon. And if you think, you know, sort of the Apollo nose cone kind of capsule that the astronauts rode to the moon, this is very similar. And what happened was the rocket launched, went into orbit. The Dragon capsule orbited twice. It has little retro rockets on it that fired and slowed it down. They brought it back into the Earth's atmosphere to slow it down enough that parachutes could deploy, and it dropped into the Pacific Ocean and was recovered. This was essentially, from what I can tell, a completely flawless flight.
Yeah, there's a lot of excitement in the media. There's a lot of stories on this in social networks. Facebook, Twitter are going crazy about SpaceX and this launch today. Why do you think people are excited about this?
Well, it's a commercial company. It's not NASA or the Russians or another country. It's not a national space program, although NASA does fund SpaceX, and they use NASA facilities to launch. They launched this, for example, from Florida today. But it is a commercial company. They from the square one, they were designed to build rockets, get them up into space, and that's where they're going. And in fact, they get some NASA funding here coming up to the tune of a couple hundred million bucks, actually, to take over NASA's responsibilities of getting supplies and crew up to the space station. Once the shuttle retires, which is going to happen next year, NASA doesn't have any heavy lift rockets that can take people into space. So they will rely on SpaceX to launch astronauts in this Dragon capsule up to the space station. And so it's very exciting that this not only went off, but went off so well.
That was astronomer and blogger Phil Plate. And we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. This is Earth Sky. I'm Jorge Salazar. Now a story about rare foxes that were lost and now found. Wildlife biologists often use motion-sensing cameras to capture evidence of threatened or endangered species in the wilderness. In late 2010, wildlife biologists working in California's Sierra Nevada mountain range found some especially exciting photos on their camera. Lindsay Patterson is here to tell us what they found.
Thanks, Jorge. What they saw were two photos of the Sierra Nevada red fox. That's a kind of fox that was feared to have completely disappeared from the region. I spoke with Diane McFarlane. She leads the Threatened, Endangered, and Sensitive Species Program for the U.S. Forest Service in the Pacific Southwest region, and I asked her about the discovery.
So we're using remote sensing cameras that are pointed at a sock containing a bait, which is normally chicken wings, and a scent lure, gusto, which has a lot of odor and calls in predators in the area. And when the carnivores come in to investigate the bait sock, that triggers the camera and we get a photo. Our biologists in the field were absolutely stunned when they pulled the camera, which is a digital camera, and they reviewed the pictures they'd gotten to find a fox.
The reason they were so surprised is because the Sierra Nevada red fox hadn't been seen in that area in over 20 years.
It's absolutely confirmed. Not only do we have photos, we have DNA from at least two individuals that have been amplified. One is a male, one is a female. And that it leads us to conclude that it's not from a long bottlenecked or highly inbred population. So we know from the genetics we can predict that there's more than just a handful of them out there.
So this is really good news for the foxes and the biologists. Diane McFarlane is really excited about it.
What we're finding now is extremely encouraging in that we may be getting enough additional individuals that we aren't going to be quite that scared, which gives us breathing room, so we're always happy for that. It's such a great feeling, and you know, this is the career high. It doesn't get any better than finding what you thought was lost.
Lindsay, it sounds like there's a lot of hope for these foxes.
Yes, there's a lot of optimism.
Thanks, Lindsay.
My pleasure.
Earth Sky's Lindsay Patterson. Find us as EarthSky on Facebook, EarthSky Science on Twitter, and at EarthSky.org. That's our show. Thanks for joining us. This week's show was recorded at the EarthSky Studios in Austin, Texas, live music capital of the world. Our producer is Michael Brennan. Executive producers, Peter Zandan, Ryan Britton, and Deborah Bird. And special thanks this week to our musical contributors, Monahans, The Black and White Years, Sleep Good, The Story of, Built by Snow, and The Oceaneers. For more information on the science and the music you heard this week, visit our website at earthsky.org. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
There are too many artists, too much art, and not enough genius, I believe. Science is the art of the next stage. There are so many artists with too much heart, and not enough reason, I'm afraid. Silence is the song of the next stage.